I really can't think of a better place to have worked for that time of my life, because just, treated so well in so many ways. Such a great community, such a great facility, such supportive parents, and the kids were just great. I mean, for me it was just bonding with the kids was a lot of fun, because a lot of them share the same sense of humor as me, or we kind of had the same interests and stuff. And of course, the soccer connection, and could talk about music, and I always had a guitar in the room, and it was just, I don't know, there was a lot of laughter. There were a lot of kids that I remember. Matter of fact, I remember once I was going through my went through boxes of old stuff, because I was cleaning things out, and I found like all my class lists. So I have like for all 17 years of my classes in here, every class, every advisory, all in this binder. And I was paging through that just before this interview, and yeah, I mean, I look at the names and I can remember kids, what they said, what like the little inside jokes we had together, what things we did. So for me, it was like 17 years of being almost like being a student at ASIJ. I felt like, I was really steeped in the culture, and knew the kids and knew the families, and where the kids had come from, where they were going, and back in, I think it was 2006 when I first got on Facebook. I mean, you were the one, the first one to tell me about it, and I thought, this is like a godsend, because now we can kind of stay connected. I'll know where the kids went and what they're doing. And I can go on Facebook now and literally every day see these kids who are now in their, the 20s to 30s. They have their own kids, they've got their own careers, and it's really quite amazing. It's not astonishing the amount of the connections we made, and how, for me, those are unforgettable. I mean, maybe many of the kids have forgotten about me, but I certainly, remember just about everybody's as I look at the names.
Welcome to episode 81 of Tokyo Alumni Podcast. Our guest today was born in San Francisco, California on Halloween in 1958. His first encounter with foreign language learning consisted of 2 terrible years of middle school German, a language he chose because his mother's side of the family immigrated to San Francisco after fleeing Nazi Germany. At the age of 16, he would meet his future wife, a Japanese girl from Tokyo, who happened to be studying there for 1 year. The relationship prompted him to begin studying Japanese upon entering the University of California, Berkeley in 1976. He enjoyed his Japanese studies so much that he declared Japanese as his major and took advantage of Berkeley's study abroad program to spend a year at ICU in Tokyo during his junior year. After graduating in the summer of 1980, he'd return to Japan, where he would begin what would become a 17-year stint as a freelance translator and interpreter, and then a 17-year stint as a Japanese language teacher at the American School in Japan. He left ASIJ in June of 2014 and has since been freelancing from his home, which is walking distance from the ASIJ campus. Welcome to the podcast.
Oh, nice to be here finally.
Yeah, so the goal was to have you on at episode 100, but why not? Episode 81. I got close
enough. I
think
we both agreed that I probably wouldn't live that long, so it's better to get me on while I'm still alive.
That too. So, right, no time like the present. So, right. 17 years seems to be a key number, right? 17 years as a freelance translator and interpreter, as well as 17 years at ASIJ. What is the deal with this number?
Yeah, well, when I quit ASIJ, I somebody was asking me, like, because it had come up in the conversation, why this 17-17 cycle? And I thought to myself, wait a minute, there's actually one more 17 cycle I left out, and that's kindergarten through senior year of college. That's 17 years also. So I had 17 years, a 17-year career as a student, 17 years as a freelancer, and then 17 years of teaching at ASIJ. And I guess now I'm in Act Four. I'm in the final 17-year stint.
So your connection, to international schools, to this Tokyo alumni community, could be broadly, broken up into two parts, right? One, as a parent, you actually sent your children, well, me and my brothers, to ASIJ as a parent, not as a faculty parent, but as a parent paying money and tuition. And then you were there also as a faculty member for about 2 decades. In that sense, you know, how did you sort of compare those two experiences?
Well, I guess, you know, you could say that I myself am an alum, a Tokyo alumnus, because I spent my junior year at ICU. So that was my first Japan experience. And then I married your mother in 1984. You were born in 1986, and we really didn't have a grand master plan. At home, I spoke English. She spoke Japanese. The plan was just to get you to become bilingual through us. You know, if you would communicate with me in English and her in Japanese, we just thought you would be bilingual. It became apparent, though, after a while that, you know, your Japanese was much stronger because, well, you spent more time with your mother. And also, you were just surrounded by Japanese speakers, by Japanese TV. Although you did pretty well in English, considering, you know, I was the only English speaker you had around you. So we thought, okay, this is okay. I mean, you know, you can be a native Japanese speaker. You can go to Japanese school. You can go through the Japanese system. But at the same time, you know, your mother spent 2 years at Seisen. So she was aware of the international school scene and its benefits. And I also thought that your future prospects would be better if you had an English language education. And also, I had heard horror stories of mixed race kids at Japanese schools, you know, being bullied and stuff. So we thought, okay, you know, let's do the international school thing. But the only thing is, we didn't know where we would put, where you could get into. We thought ASIJ had the most impressive program. And the first level was back at what they called the ASIJ NK in Nakameguro. And in order to prepare you for that, we put you in an English speaking playgroup. There weren't very many of those at the time. And the kids in that playgroup, which was in the Nishihara area, those other kids would go on to Nishimachi or British school. And, you know, there were kids like Chris Duke, who was at ASIJ, Sheena David, was it? She went to Nishimachi, Ize Imai. You know, it was interesting because it was a very small and close-knit international community back then. So it's like almost, it seemed like everybody knew everybody. And so at Child's Play, you kind of like were able to firm up your English skills. We sent you to ASIJ for screening, and Richard Snell, who was the head of the NK at the time, said, welcome on board. And from 1990, you became an ASIJ student.
You know, as a parent, so there's this early episode. I think the main question a lot of people my age, right, who now have kids are 2, 3, 6, 7 years old, is the money, right? That has not changed. It was super expensive in the 80s. It's super expensive today. How big did that play a role in the conversation, you know, how does one afford international school, and, you know, is it worth it?
Well, I was, you know, freelance translator and interpreter at the time and doing quite well. So fortunately, money was not an issue for us in the beginning. It is more of an issue now for people because I think, you know, I mean, I'm not going to get into specific figures, but, you know, I was probably making, you know, three times maybe what your average businessman makes now. We were just making a lot of money at the time. It was crazy. So paying, you know, $2 million a year for you, tuition plus the school bus was not that big a deal. The thing is, you know, we didn't know in 1990 that, well, we knew that Will was headed in that direction because he was born in 89. And then the third brother, Max, was born in 1994. So when there were three of you getting ready to go to ASIJ, we thought, okay, this is getting kind of crazy. And that's kind of what led to me pursuing the idea of actually teaching there.
And I think, you know, with people who have multiple children, sometimes they have to choose who goes to international school, who doesn't. Did that ever cross your mind, right? Three kids. I was basically in the system long enough. I imagine I would have stayed, but was that ever part of the conversation that, you know, we can afford two kids to go international school, but a third, you know, stays in a Japanese school?
Yeah, definitely. It definitely was because, you know, by the time Max was born, you know, it was costing us about $2 million for each of you. So to have three of you at ASIJ at the same time would have been six million yen, which is a considerable amount of money. And we dealt with it by, you know, we had been living downtown, so we moved closer to school so that we could cut out the school bus. By that time, by the time Max was three, is when I got hired at ASIJ. So that pretty much solved everything right there because you guys got scholarships, 100%. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it was fully covered. And, you know, since that time, they've rolled back the benefits. And now they, I think they only pay for up to two children. And then from the third one, you pay the full price. And even for the first two, you pay a percentage of the tuition now. So under the current rules, I don't know if we would have been able to afford it back then. Back then, it was a far more generous pay package.
Interesting. So you have kind of this unique background where you were willing to take a pay cut to work for at ASIJ because of the benefits that, you know, they would provide.
Yeah, well, not only that, but here I was, you know, a freelancer with three kids. You know, your mom didn't work, so we really had no safety net other than our savings. So for me, it was a matter of like, after 17 years of freelance work, wanting to do something different, first of all, just a different kind of job. When I got to know the school, got acquainted with the kind of work it was, I thought, wow, I could do this full time. And so it was taking a pay cut, but at the same time, I got assurance that I had never had before. And I, you know, also you guys were all paid for, plus there were other bells and whistles, plus the amount of time off is ridiculous. I mean, teachers get like 10 weeks off in the summer. For me, that was crazy because I was working all the time. So to work 180 days a year or something was like, you know, a gift.
I think, you know, the million-dollar question that's come up in this podcast, that comes up in my personal life too with my friends with kids is it worth it? And, you know, the main answer I give is also context, right? I think worth is very different for someone making $400,000 a year versus someone making $100,000 a year. So sort of with that caveat also in mind, what would your perspective be, you know, being a parent who, you know, even though you did get the, you know, scholarships for your kids later on, I think you did end up paying out of pocket at least $300,000-$400,000 to ASIJ, something like that, right?
Oh, in the very beginning, I forgot what it was, but yeah, for you through fourth grade and for Will through first grade. I'm not sure what it comes out to, but it was a you know, a fair amount of money. Yeah.
So over $200,000. And so did you think, and plus the pay cut to work there. So is it worth it? Is it worth sending kids to international schools?
I think it's definitely worth it. If you can afford it, if you're sacrificing your savings, sacrificing some part of your lifestyle just to send your kids to international schools, it's probably not a good idea, because I mean, there are definite benefits, but you got to have some money in the bank. You got to be prepared for the future. You got to be prepared for college. And I know plenty of mixed race kids who have gone through the Japanese system and have done fine. You know, they got into great Japanese colleges. They're now working. Some of them have gone overseas, but plenty of people I know have taken that route. So it works. It definitely works.
So in 97, you begin working full time at ASIJ. You were there for a while. How did ASIJ change during your two decades there?
There were good changes and there were not so good changes. I would say that the positive changes were the campus, you know, the actual facility just kept on getting upgraded and more and more and more and more, so that, you know, every time, you know, a graduate would come back, they'd say, my goodness, this place looks like, you know, looks completely different. So the actual facility, you know, just got better and better and better. I think, you know, the students, the families, the community, it's always been great. You know, it's just, you know, from day one, that was just always superb. I think maybe management style, you know, from the perspective of me as a faculty member, it got a little bit top down, you know, in the last few years there. And for a person like me, I tend to prefer autonomy. I prefer to do things my own way. And that worked for the first, I don't know, 10, 12 years or so. But then towards the end, admin got a little bit top down, and, you know, clashing viewpoints were not permitted. So there were certain sticking points between me and my administrators that we never quite got past. And I think that that contributed to my own personal disillusionment. And so I, you know, after, well, in my 17th year, I decided, okay, this would be the last year. It happened rather suddenly, but there was sort of an incident between me and my administrators that just prompted me to kind of do a little bit of soul searching. And I realized, I think I've done enough of this. It was a good ride. You know, I have no regrets at all. And, you know, 99% really good memories, but I was just prompted to think about, you know, what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. I was, at the time, 55 years old. So I thought, okay, I'm going to be working for another 10, 15 years. Why don't I go back to freelancing? And that's what I did. And I don't regret that the decision at all. It's worked out very well. The last 8 years have been really nice. It's been a complete change of lifestyle because it's enabled me to kind of leave that bubble. It was a very comfortable bubble, a very secure bubble, but still I realized after I left that I was, you know, kind of behind the ASIJ curtain, and I was really not living as a free soul in Tokyo, which is what I had originally been doing. So mm-hmm. I felt sort of like it was like moving back to Tokyo mm-hmm. by leaving ASIJ. I felt like, okay, now I'm back where I was before. So it was like almost like literally going from one country to another.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that seems to be one of the more prominent criticisms people have of international schools in general. It's the idea of bubbles, and people don't get out of the bubbles. You have people live in, you know, countries for many years who don't interact with the local culture. Whereas you feel like when you left, you were able to sort of reintegrate back to, you know, the real Japan, not ASIJ, which is not really Japan. And, you know, you've spent more time in Japan than I have. Actually, I was doing the math the other day, right? You've been in Japan longer than most Japanese people. Just because you're old, right? So you add up the years, and you've been there longer than the average Japanese. And we've talked about this before, how when I look at Japanese culture, I am a Japanese national, whereas you're not, right? You grew up in a monocultural surrounding, and then very bicultural once you were in an international marriage. Do you feel like that gives you kind of a different perspective? And like, do you ever kind of feel maybe how I feel right now living in Korea or Honduras? Because you're not Japanese, do you ever feel like these limitations, like no matter how long you spend in Japan, that you're never quite, as I said, even though ironically you've lived there longer than most people, that you're not really part of that society?
You know, growing up in California, in Marin County, it was in its own way a good place and a good time. And that kind of world that I grew up in is now gone. But the thing is, even at the age of 16, 17, I mean, I knew I wanted to leave it behind. I knew that I had outgrown it. I knew that, you know, at the very least, you know, I wanted to go to college outside of Marin. So I wanted to go to definitely to Berkeley. And if I didn't go to Berkeley, I would have gone to San Francisco State. So I knew I had to get out of Marin. Once I was at Berkeley, I thought, okay, you know, once I graduate, I maybe want to live in San Francisco. But when I did my junior year in Tokyo, that like sealed the deal. And it's like, okay, this is my place. This is where I belong. So I made that discovery rather early in life when you think about it, because the first time I came here was after my freshman year. I was already going out with your mother, and I finished my freshman year at Cal. And then in the summer of 77, I stayed at her parents' place in Tokyo for 6 weeks. You know, I mean, at the time we didn't tell them, you know, I was the boyfriend. I was just, you know, her friend from California when she had studied there for a year. But in summer of 77, you know, coming to Tokyo was like, you know, I thought this is the greatest place in the world. And that's why I decided to spend my junior year there, which is the 78-79 school year. And that was just incredible.
What made it so great? What made Japan in the late 70s something so appealing in comparison to California in the late 70s?
Everything about it was just exciting. Everything. Because, you know, I had just started learning the language. I mean, summer of 77, I've only been studying the language for 9 months at that point, because, you know, I started in August or September of 76. And so, you know, I'm kind of getting that under my belt, could, you know, communicate fairly well, considering I hadn't even been studying for a year. You know, at Cal, they pushed it really hard. I mean, we started, it was the quarter system. So we started the first quarter, Japanese 1A with 100 students. And the next quarter, 1B had 50. And then the third quarter, 25. So a 50% drop off every quarter because the workload was so high. But I loved it. I loved learning the kanji. I loved everything about learning Japanese. And then when I got to Tokyo, it was like, okay, I get to learn even more. I get to find out all about Tokyo, which was just the coolest place in the world, just for everything. I mean, there's a reason why people come here as tourists, and they're, you know, just kind of their eyes pop out and say, my gosh, you know, what is this place? And I had the advantage, though, of at least being able to understand stuff. I mean, people come here and just sort of that wow effect, but I was actually able to look at stuff, analyze it, understand it, and, you know, build on my learning. So it never got old. It never got routine. It never got tiresome. And as I mentioned, I had the advantage of not belonging to an organization where I had to, you know, play by a lot of very irrational rules and unfair rules. You know, the hierarchies that exist, that tend to exist in Japanese companies and stuff. I would have never survived that. But I got to tell you, man, for a young man, it was just the perfect place in every way. You know,
it's the right place at the right time, it seems like, too, because
never a boring time. You know, you could go out every night to a different place. You could always meet new people. You know, they were always interested in you. And, you know, they loved the fact that they could speak to, you know, non-Japanese in Japanese. So, you know, there was literally nothing to not like about it.
So the Japan plan was pretty early on, it seems like. And you know, you just pursued that path from late 70s all the way to the present. When it comes to linguistics, obviously it connects very much to what you do professionally. At what point, or if ever, did you feel like, okay, I am like a true bilingual? Because again, it's a different scenario than a lot of people who are my friends, right, or myself, where we grew up with a language. In your case, if someone was to ask you, hey, I'm learning Japanese, how long will it take me to be at a Japanese person's level? How would you respond to that?
Well, I mean, I'm never going to get there, because I mean, I'm always going to speak with, you know, an accent. I'm always going to make some kind of mistake, you know. Fortunately, I generally know what I do, and I squirm, of course, and relive that moment of horror, you know, every time it happens. But unfortunately, it does, you know, continue to happen. So yeah, or there's stuff that I know I can say, and I want to say it, and I can't think of the word. But that happens in English too, and I sometimes can't think of that. So the thing about language is that, you know, whether you're monolingual or bilingual, just expressing yourself is a challenge. You know, coming up with the right word. I mean, you can be an American who knows only English and still not be able to express yourself adequately. So, yeah, that's just, you know, verbal communication is a challenge, you know, no matter how many languages you're working in.
You know, Tokyo Alumni Podcast, we're going to shift the focus back to ASIJ here, close to two decades. Any specific moments that have sort of been etched in your mind forever during your time at ASIJ?
That's a tough question, because you really can't narrow it down. I mean, as a student, okay, think back on your own career as a student there. I mean, do you ever remember like any moments that were like, you know, stood out to you? I mean, were there great victories? Or because as a teacher, it seemed like it was more like a daily wins and losses every day, you know, because there would be good days, bad days, good classes, bad classes, you know, good planning that went awry. Just, you know, people you get along with, people you don't get along with, and on and on and on. And so, you know, it's all kind of like a blur right now, but I really can't think of a better place to have worked for that time of my life, because just, you know, treated so well in so many ways, such a great community, such a great facility, such supportive parents, and you know, kids were just great. I mean, you know, for me, it was just bonding with the kids was a lot of fun because, you know, a lot of them shared the same sense of humor as me, or we kind of had the same interests and stuff. And of course, I the soccer connection, and, you know, could talk about music, and I always had a guitar in the room, and, you know, it was just, I don't know, there was a lot of laughter. There were, you know, a lot of kids that, you know, I remember. Matter of fact, I remember once I was going through my boxes of old stuff because I was cleaning things out, and I found like all my class lists. So I have like all 17 years of my classes in here, every class, every advisory, you know, all in this binder. And I, you know, I was paging through that just before this interview, and yeah, I mean, you know, I look at the names and I can remember kids, what they said, you know, what, like the little inside jokes we had together, what things we did. So for me, it was like 17 years of being almost like being a student at ASIJ. I felt like, you know, I was really steeped in the culture and knew the kids and knew the families and you know, where the kids had come from, where they were going, you know. And back in, I think it was 2006 when I first got on Facebook. I mean, you were the one, the first one to tell me about it. And I thought, this is like a godsend, because now we can kind of stay connected. I'll know where the kids went and what they're doing. And, you know, I can go on Facebook now and literally every day see these kids who are now in their, you know, their 20s to 30s. They have their own kids. They've got their own careers. And it's really quite amazing. It's not astonishing the amount of the connections we made. And, you know, how, for me, those are unforgettable. I mean, maybe many of the kids have forgotten about me, but I certainly, you know, remember just about everybody as I look at the names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it definitely. And this, you know, is something, a theme I see with the former students who will tell me, hey, can you get, you know, this former teacher or this teacher on? And there's certain, you know, teachers they can connect with. And there's certain teachers that, you know, really don't connect with the kids. So it is interesting to see like how different, I guess, that is. And I think the main thing is just having that connection, right? Because then it's kind of like connects to, I guess, what we're talking next about, soccer and coaching. You know, when that connection's not there, it's like, what's the point? You know, what's the point? What's the point of anything, really? So, you know, you were a Japanese teacher, but you also did some coaching, and you've watched, so, you know, students from the late 90s up to the mid 2000s. And how have you seen the ASIJ soccer program evolve during your time there? And actually, yeah, we'll just start with that question. How did the program look like when you first arrived, and what did it look like when you left?
Well, my experience with soccer kind of mirrors my experience with Japanese language, in that I picked it up. I started with nothing, because, you know, when I started learning Japanese, I didn't know anything about it. I just happened to kind of encounter it through your mother. And soccer, in 1985, a friend of mine was working for Dentsu, and he got tickets for the Kirin Cup. And the Uruguay national team was playing Santos, and he got a ticket to that game. I'd never been to a soccer game in my life. And I, you know, we went to the national stadium, and I saw it, and I was just hooked. I thought, man, this is wonderful. This is amazing. And so I bought a ball, you know, I kind of learned to play on my own. I started up a team. I watched every game I could, you know, in person. I got every video I could get my hands on. At the time, they showed very little soccer on TV. There was, you know, Mitsubishi Diamond Soccer on Saturday nights, you know, half hour. That was about the only show they had. But, you know, I just soaked it up like a sponge. So by the time I got the ASIJ in 97, I already had about, I don't know, 12 years of experience, but it felt like a lifetime. And, I was never the greatest player in the world, but I had just learned a lot about the game, and also sort of developed my own vision of what, you know, I wanted the game to look like. And when I saw kids learning skills, I thought, you know, I knew where they were on the continuum of learning, because, you know, I was on that continuum also, although I was a very sort of slow learner, but, you know, I knew where they were, and I knew, you know, what they were trying to do. And I felt that I could assist them in the, you know, create a program where they could have fun playing the game, and they, and we could all just bond, you know, over our love of the game. Mm-hmm. So the main thing I changed about ASIJ soccer when I started in 1997 was, first of all, I lobbied to open up the program, because up to that point, there had been two teams only, an A team and a B team at the middle school for boys only. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, over a number of meetings, I said, come on, guys, we've got to open this up to girls, first of all. There was no place for sixth graders. We got to open up the sixth graders. So mm-hmm. when I first got there, there were two boys teams, so about 35, 36 kids. And I would say after about three, 4 years, we had literally 100 kids in the program. Mm-hmm. So like when you were in sixth grade, seventh grade, eighth grade, that was about when we had our peak. And I don't know if you remember, but we had not only A and B teams, we had A, B, C, D, E. We even had an F team back in your day, you know? Mm-hmm. So we had so many teams that it was hard for us to find other teams to play, but schools like St. Mary's, schools like CAJ, you know, they got on board. Since, mm-hmm. you know, they knew ASIJ numbers were, you know, shooting off the charts, they started fielding more players as well. So the first thing I changed was just the structure of the program, and I swung open the doors. And so we had more kids playing, and that stuck. And concurrent to that, you had kids who were coming up through the system who were playing in Japanese clubs and stuff. Or we would get kids who were, you know, who had been living in the States and on travel teams. And I just found that more and more of the ASIJ student body consisted of kids who were playing soccer at higher and higher levels. So the quality of the middle school, quality of the high school really took off. And that had nothing to do with me. It was just a historical thing. It was just the game of soccer was taking off, you know, around the world. And I think, you know, the premiership, when it started, mid-90s, you know, that's when.
Yeah, it was early 90s, I think, yeah.
Yeah, but that was when there was a real, you know, influx of capital. And also the Bosman ruling, you know, which meant that, you know, Europeans could play anywhere. And so now you had these like super team mega, you know, mega clubs from about the late 90s. So the popularity of world soccer, you know, really took off from that time. So that there was just sort of this synergy, you know, with, you know, kids watching soccer, kids playing soccer, kids involved at, you know, in high level competition. And so I just year after year, you got more and more talent.
You know, going back to, so your experience from 85 to 96. So in what ways did you sort of gain playing or coaching experience that you were able to use at ASIJ during those periods of time?
Okay. So from the time I started learning the game in 1985 until I started ASIJ in 97 was a period of my own personal development as both a player of the game and a follower of the game. And crucial to that process was my involvement with the sport of futsal, which is, you know, five-a-side indoor soccer. And I was fascinated by futsal because it offered everything that soccer does, except in a more sort of concentrated, intense form. And I called up the JFA to ask them, you know, I'd heard from somebody that the sport exists. Somebody had told me that there's such thing as indoor soccer. And I thought, that's amazing. I want to find out about that. I called the JFA and they referred me to Takao Sakai, who was the godfather of futsal in Japan. And sport had not really taken off yet in Japan, but he's a wonderful man. And, you know, and he is a professor of philosophy and just a very interesting guy, a very international guy. And he wanted to meet me and he had a futsal team and he invited me to play with his team. And then, you know, after I got to know him, he said, plus, you know, we're doing this Japan Futsal Federation thing and you want to get involved with that. So he brought me on board, you know, he took me under his wing and I became a director of that. And then eventually, you know, we had been working separate from the JFA, but then since FIFA started officially organizing their own version of futsal, the JFA was given a directive by FIFA to recognize the Futsal Federation of Japan. So we became officially part of the FIFA JFA family from 1994. So I became a director, a JFA director. I was a member of the original futsal committee. I would travel with the national team to you know, Australia, to Italy, to Shanghai, you know, competitions. And so I actually was involved in futsal in an official capacity for those years, you know, throughout the 90s. And you know, that was a crucial part of my development. It's just, you know, a member of the football family, because learning about football meant learning about futsal, which meant learning more about football. So I had these sort of two tracks going on mentally, and that is sort of the those are the seeds of my evolution, you know, as a coach and a player and a follower of the game.
I was going to say, so you spoke a bit about the start, the early years of ASIJ, the latter years of ASIJ. Did anything change? You know, so obviously huge soccer boom, early 90s. I was there, right? Japan makes the World Cup in 98. We host the World Cup in 2002. You know, unprecedented levels of interest. Did interest wane nationally too? Because I left the country, you know, in 2005. And then, you know, I barely lived there. So did the soccer boom sort of persist at ASIJ, or did things change?
No, it intensified, if anything. And the kids got better and better and better. So that by the time your little brother, you know, Max was on the varsity team, you know, they were probably playing the highest level of soccer that I had ever seen at ASIJ. And at that, when Max was in his senior year, I put together this tournament where I went around to the local high schools, went to ICU high school, went to another high school, Meisei, and I said, you want to play in a competition together? And so I had them come to ASIJ. Canadian Academy came up from Kobe, and we put together what I called the Tama Cup. And so we had this was like the fruition of my own personal dream for the ASIJ soccer program, that we would have ties in both the local community and the international school community. And, you know, we would all get to know each other through soccer. And it was a great tournament, and ASIJ won the tournament, you know, beating all the other teams convincingly. And then we even have you remember that video of Max scoring the goal from the touchline? You know, he just rounds his player and then just curls the ball, you know, from the touchline, just, you know, the upper 90. And, you know, that was sort of the cherry on top. But unfortunately, that was my last year at ASIJ, and nobody carried the torch from there. Mm-hmm. So the Tama Cup had one edition only, and yeah, you know, it could have been something that, you know, changed the program, improved the program quite a bit. But unfortunately, nobody was there to take over for me.
Yeah, that's unfortunate to hear, because you feel like, you know, even without bias, objectively looking, it is one of the only sports where, you know, multiple kids get into Division I schools, like soccer wise. They're playing at, they're not going to beat, ASIJ can't beat like an Intahai team, but they could, you know, probably beat more than half the schools in Tokyo. So I've always been interested myself to see, you know, how ASIJ, if they had a proper, you know, a proper program and they were playing, you know, various Tokyo teams, how they do. And I reckon they would do very well, just because they have international kids. And who knows, maybe in the future, you know, if they can start booking games again against Japanese schools, the program might have a renaissance once again.
I wanted the kids to have, you know, year-round playing opportunities. And, you know, the idea was just frowned upon, because there's this American idea that there are three seasons and they all have to be different. And we can't have kids playing the same sport all year round. And I thought, no, we could. And I remember that telling the first athletic director that, hey, you know, the field's open on Sunday. Why don't we play on Sundays? And he looked at me like I'd just come from Mars. He said, play on Sundays? How is that possible? International schools can't play on Sundays. And I said, sure. If you invite Japanese teams here, we can play, you know, as many teams as you want. And he was like, never, no way. We cannot have people, you know, playing on Sunday. Yeah. But anyway, that's a conversation for another time.
Well, I know you didn't really want to do this part, but I do always ask former coaches from the international schools, you know, what sort of their best players were, or in your case, just a list of memorable players is, like, I guess the format you would prefer, right? Rather than having a best 11. So what were the sort of the names that, you know, that you remember the most seeing, you know, ASIJ soccer program for the last 17 years?
Well, it's, you know, it's hard to narrow it down, but, you know, I mean, if, you know, we were making our own lists, and I was sort of, you know, if I had to, like, list certain players who really, I thought, you know, mastered their positions, I would say that, you know, the goalkeeper position was always a little bit shaky because we never really had, you know, goalkeepers that had the sort of experience and training that, you know, you want in players who are, you know, 17, 18 years old. But, you know, certainly the Yonamine brothers, you know, Brian and John brought a lot of quality. And then Kai Astomi from Max's year was quite good as well. And then for defenders, you know, I thought, you know, Ken Saito was always a great leader. Henrik Olsen in later years, Julian Watanabe, Joe Talbot, Kazu Chen. And then defensive midfielders. I mean, we really have to separate the attacking midfielders from the defensive midfielders. And from your year, I thought Kento Hirooka, you know, he was sort of the first player I ever saw at ASIJ who actually mastered that position in a convincing way, where he was, like, not only, you know, controlling things in the midfield, but also setting the attack. And that was added a new dimension, I thought, to the varsity that I had never seen before. And then, you know, Koyajima from a year ahead of Max also did that, as did Max. You know, he was a great defensive midfielder as well. Taiki Wada. And then, you know, in later years, Sean Murphy, who he graduated after I left. But when Sean was, he was originally from CAJ. And he came to ASIJ first for the passport program. And I had already started a futsal class at the passport program. And when Sean came after fifth grade, I mean, he was doing things I had never seen an international school player do before. And so he went on to play at the University of Washington in St. Louis. I think he played all 4 years there. And then attacking midfield, you know, yourself, Rodolfo, Michael Lancet, Tak Matsumoto, the Hallberg boys, you know, Ethan and Kai, although I think Kai tended to play a little more defensive. Winston Poole was unfortunately a player that we, you know, only had for a couple of years, but he was just a monster, an absolute monster. And then, you know, Chris Kleindl was one of the greats. Haru Kent, Timmy Beer, Takuto Wada. And then, you know, we've had quite a few interesting forwards, attackers, or strikers, I guess you'd say. But, you know, there was really one, I thought, only one who really left me, like, always, like, amazed, and that was Todd Kawada. You know, who just was a sort of a magician with the ball. He would do very, very audacious stuff. And it was a delight to watch him, because you could tell he was just having the time of his life, just enjoying playing the game and just bringing his own game, stamping his own signature onto the game.
Yeah, it's a good list. It's a good list. It's a bit long, but 17 years. So is that about 20, yeah. 25, I think you mentioned. So about 25. I guess if it was a World Cup squad, right, it's 26 this year because of COVID. I think they get three more. It used to be 23. So that would essentially be your World Cup squad, the 26 players from the 17 years. Thank you for providing me that list. And I think this kind of takes us now towards the end here. At the very end, I like to ask my guest what is coming up in their lives the next few years, next few decades. So what is coming up for you?
Well, at this point, you know, survival, because being a translator right now means competing with AI, because machine translation has become really good. So as a translator, I'm only as good as the stuff that people feed into to AI translators. And right now I'm competing with them. And so we'll see how long it lasts, because, you know, one thing's for sure, the AI is only going to get better and better. So we'll see where that leaves human translators such as myself. But I plan to stay in the game for as long as I can. And when there's no more need for that, well, I'll think of what to do next. But for now, I'll just stick with being a freelancer and, you know, have a good life doing that. It's an interesting lifestyle, because every day is like an election, a referendum, that, you know, where your clients vote. They either vote for you or they ignore you. And every time you get a job, it's like, okay, I got another vote. It's another victory. And that's, you know, that takes me to tomorrow. That takes me to next week. That takes me to next month. So it's, you know, every day is sort of a challenge, but yeah, so goes the life of a freelancer.
So that concludes our podcast. Again, I wish this was episode 100, but episode 81, I almost made it. Thank you so much for being a guest today. It was interesting to hear your perspective, sort of this official capacity, right? A little different from, you know, when we just talk casually. And maybe we have you back on, maybe when we hit 100, I don't know. I want some guests to come back. I haven't got to that point yet, but maybe eventually, if you can be alive until then, we'll have you back.
That's right. That's right. Like I said, survival. I'll try to stay alive until episode 100. And maybe one of these days you could do also a roundtable, you know, with several people, you know, on a certain subject. You might have your we might have a soccer roundtable one of these days, you know, or you know, ASIJ roundtable or whatever. So try to bear that in mind as well.
Yeah, that's actually a good idea, definitely. Mm-hmm. And on that note, again, thank you very much, and have a good night.
Okay.